Well, the straw that breaks the camel's back might be here, and by the back, we mean the entire markets, all to fight inflation that might already be completely gone. Let's talk about all of this and more in today's bottom line report, because you might think, wait a minute, how can inflation be gone? Prices are still so high. Just wait until you see what we have to show you. But first, understand the following. You've got Mr. Scott Solomon, who's been working for T. Rowe Price for over 18 years, suggesting that usually the 10-year treasury yield has to match where the Federal Reserve's rate of interest is. Well, the Federal Reserve's rate of interest is actually up here, which means we still have more work to do on getting that 10-year up. The 10-year right now sits at 4.63%. Which is ridiculously high, well higher than the 4.3% most people thought treasuries would end up topping out at. This is leading the yield curve to steepen. This is a way of generally suggesting that we're coming out of the potential fear of a recession, but unfortunately that's driven by pain. And all of this to get inflation down, which when we look at the Costco earnings report, well, let's just say, might not be that necessary. Take a look at the Costco earnings report. Costco reported $4.20 of earnings in the last quarter has a lot to tell us about inflation. Important to look at this directly. It's also worth noting that Costco doesn't seem to have flash mobs or flash robs as much as other points, as much as other businesses rather, maybe because of the choke point of the businesses. But when we actually look at, and Costco selling 1 ounce gold bars now, limit 2 per customer, what do we find for inflation? Well, Costco tells us that inflation that they had estimated would be in the 3 to 4% range. However, for the fourth quarter, they actually think that inflation will be closer to that 1 to 2% range. And despite their estimate that it would be as low as 1 to 2%, they actually saw it trend down in the quarter. Now, what does that look like visually? Well, visually, I think what they're suggesting is inflation was expected to be somewhere around this level. We'll call that 3 to 4%. What they actually ended up getting was 1 to 2%, but then inflation that's actually started to fall even more at the end of the quarter. And so this made me curious about reading the rest of the report and wondering, wait a minute, what's actually going on with inflation? So here we go. We have analysts asking Costco directly, wait a minute, if inflation is on pace to be at 1 to 2%, should we be prepared for deflation? And Costco literally says the following. Well, look, some things are flat, some things are up a tiny little bit, some things are down and trending down. We think that 1 to 2% is accurate, but let's be clear now, word for word, focus on this red section right here. That being said, we're not seeing a big change, at least it's trending that way. Who knows what tomorrow brings? And as it relates to, well, as I say, as it relates to us, we are always pushing prices down as fast as we can. We want to be the first to lower prices when those things happen and drive sales. Folks, this is the start of deflation. It is the start of businesses waking up to realize they need to provide value at different price points to provide consumers an opportunity to actually buy. This means when we go through the rest of the earnings call for Costco, it's no surprise. People are buying less TVs and less big purchase items, and they're spending more on smaller to mid-sized items, yet instead of buying as much as they were before, they're buying less because ultimately we've got less. As a society, we have less to spend, we have less excess savings. By some regards, they're all gone. And the Federal Reserve's 5.5% interest rates are finally starting to break the back of the markets. On top of this, it's worth considering, wait a minute, what actually happens when gas prices go up and people have less money to spend on stuff? Well, as gas prices go up, we think that means more inflation. That's because gas and energy do make up a component of CPI. Well, what happens then when people have less money to spend on stuff? Gas prices up, people have less money available to spend on stuff. That means there's less demand for goods and services, which ends up driving the price of goods and services down. But if input costs go up because the cost of freight or the cost of driving around as a real estate agent or whatever go up, shouldn't that increase what companies charge people? No, because what people get charged is usually driven by people's willingness to pay. If people are willing to pay less and costs go up, guess who loses? The business. The business has to absorb higher costs or lay people off or cut to crimp or to prevent the crimping of their profit margin even further. This is why consumer staples are having so much of a problem. People realize finally that what these companies had, like Target or Macy's, was faux pricing power. Basically, they saw revenues go up after the pandemic because everything was more expensive. And thanks to inflation, these companies' revenue went up. But that was faux pricing power. That was on real pricing power. Real pee-pee, really good pee-pee, is driven by people's demand for your product, whether prices are high or low, and that you can actually increase demand relative to your competition in an environment where margins are being squeezed. That's hard to do. So be careful to fall into the trap that, higher gas prices definitely mean inflation's going up, and therefore, we're going to be higher for even longer. What's happening right now is the Federal Reserve is probably pushing markets to the point where something is potentially likely to break. We had a banking crisis at lower 10-year treasury yields than where we sit now. A quick reminder to check out househack.com for my real estate startup, which is now fundraising. Many of you are sending us messages suggesting you're excited to have exposure to real estate out of your area, real estate at scale, getting in on a startup at the ground floor, especially with our one-to-one valuation. Obviously, there's OPEX and there are fees associated with fundraising, but the beauty is whatever we raise is the valuation we are putting on the company. There's no excess premium. So we're really raising at roughly a cash value. Learn more about all of that at househack.com. Very excited about it, and I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure this company does as well as possible. I'm personally very excited about it, and I can't wait for you to join us. But obviously, with any startup, there are risks. So read about them at househack.com. Consider this, folks. The banking crisis occurred in March when interest rates were 4%. Now interest rates are 4.6%. Why are we not hearing more about a banking crisis? Well, we're not hearing more about a banking crisis because the Fed's already set up a bailout facility called the Bank Term Funding Program, which enables banks to borrow money at levels where their treasury bonds are assumed to have lost zero value. Even though the market value of their treasury bonds has plummeted, they could still borrow as if they are fully valued. So in other words, the Federal Reserve is printing money to bail out the bank crisis that they are causing, which is actually limiting the Fed's awareness that, wait a minute, maybe they've already gone too far. And this is leading individuals to suggest, okay, is it possible if the Fed keeps going like this, they're going to break something even greater, something they won't be able to quickly solve? And the answer to that is yes, absolutely. What they might end up breaking could be real estate. The housing market is not looking great right now. And that is more anecdotal over just the last 2 weeks. You can't even get this in the data yet. You've got to be in markets to understand this. What I want you to do as an experiment is go to an open house this weekend. This video is being filmed on Thursday. Bottom line report. Go to an open house this weekend. I want you to ask a realtor, hey, just wondering, you know, how's the market changed over the last couple months? And you're going to get the following responses. It hit a wall. It's weird. It slowed down. I don't know what happened. After back to school, there are less buyers. It's really important to remember that winter is usually a hard time for real estate. But when you add to that, wait a minute, we have rates that we haven't seen since 2006. Affordability is at record lows. Then it's no surprise that I believe, as well as many other agents, that prices locally peaked in July of this year, that days on the market is rising, that realtors are pushing more agents for price cuts, that new listings are selling for below what old listings were selling for. And I know a lot of people, they still have this belief that, wait a minute, Kevin, but inventory is still at record lows. That might be true. In fact, look, inventory can be at record lows. Consider this. You could have 100 homes on the market, which could be record low. 20 people buying per month means you have 5 months of supply, right? 20 buyers, 100 homes, 5 months, 20 buyers per month. Got it? Okay. What happens when that buyer level goes down in half because they've all left or got priced out? Well, now all of a sudden, you still have a record low number of homes on the market, 100. Now all of a sudden, you go to 10 buyers. Uh-oh, your month's supply just doubled. You now have 20 months of supply of inventory. This is the pain that we're starting to see coming. And that's going to be a lot harder for the Federal Reserve to fix quickly, mostly because of the lack of appetite for the Federal Reserve to actually drop rates quickly. In other news, GameStop is up 8% in pre-market as well. Ryan Cohen has been named the CEO effective immediately. In my opinion, this is quite literally an AMC move where you do anything you possibly can to prop up a share so you can prepare for a money raise. No guarantees, but this is common. Do something that's going to be very, very, very attractive to retail shareholders. Meme the stock up and then dump on the shareholders. Got enough of that with AMC. Barclays tells us that right now, while we are seeing a rush to cash, we're actually not seeing as much of a stock market shift towards negativity as you would think, despite the fact that people are now worried about stagflation, which again, if you read the Costco earnings call, is absolutely ridiculous. And I know you might say, hey, Kevin, come on. One earnings report does not make a trend. But we've got to be clear here. Every single day in the course member live stream, we are talking about inflation and we are analyzing various different company earnings calls of different industries every single day. And all of them are saying the same thing. Inflation is gone. But remember, folks, the Fed's a clown here. Fed told us inflation would be short-term transitory, and it ended up, maybe it'll be long-term transitory, but they basically told us, don't worry, we don't need to raise rates, inflation will be transitory. That was obviously wrong, and that was at a time when companies were yelling at us saying, every price is going up, the inflation is crazy. Leading indicators were very, very clear if we were reading company earnings calls, which we do in the course member live streams. Now the opposite is clear, which means the Fed is clearly overdoing it. But what's interesting is Barclays is actually arguing that equity inflows in September have been mildly positive. And one of the reasons we're not seeing the market go down more is because so many people hedged, they don't actually have to remove money from markets. Instead, they're able to take some of their profits and add to their long positions. Kind of a very interesting scenario. Something that even though hedge funds, you know, have a reputation for negativity, it seems like it was a good move. It wasn't a good move going into the new year in 2023. Pretty much hedge funds got their shorts absolutely burned. But in this environment, hedging was very, very good. Retail ETF inflows have slowed down, though, as it seems like maybe retail is pretty heavily allocated and there's less cash available to be able to buy the dip, whereas hedge funds have a little bit more cash available and they're taking that new money and not necessarily adding to longs, even though some are. They're actually potentially lowering some of their positioning just to sit on the sidelines with some of that cash, which could come in to push for an aggressive rally once we get through this short-term insanity with what's going on with treasury yields. But it shouldn't be a surprise that cash is seeing such record inflows. Here you could see the money market line, which is the light blue line here, getting record inflows for this year to date. Well, this is obviously something that makes sense because you get no market risk, pure liquidity, and 5.5% yields. That's phenomenal. You don't even have the bond market risk with your money sitting in money markets. It's absolutely incredible. Now, for those who bought treasuries, as long as you hold them to duration, you also have no market risk, but you lose the liquidity that money markets could give you. Something to keep in mind. Now, the question is, who the heck is buying all of these treasury bonds instead of money markets? Because think about it. You've got the Fed dumping bonds, central banks dumping bonds, foreign countries are dumping bonds. So many institutions are dumping bonds. We've got banks dumping bonds. We've got mutual funds dumping bonds. Why would you buy bonds when you could just make 5.5% in yield on money markets? Well, apparently it's households and hedge funds that are actually betting on bonds. Now, there's a risk to this. There's a risk that rates go higher and principal value goes down. That risk goes away if you hold those bonds forever. But what is the real thing that probably households and hedge funds are planning on? Why would households and hedge funds be buying so many bonds? Why did 3.6 million treasury direct accounts get opened so people could buy bonds? Well, part of it is because it took a while for money markets to actually catch up with Treasury bond yields. If you went back to November of last year, Treasury bonds were yielding around 4% and money markets were still yielding around 2%. So you got a higher yield for a much longer if you got into bonds. But in addition to that, there is a real speculative aspect of owning bonds. And that is this idea that, hey, look, nobody actually expects these yields to last this long. The belief is something's going to break, the Fed's going to cut rates very rapidly, we'll take the staircase up on rates and we'll take the elevator down. That's because something will break, the Fed will be forced to bail something out, they'll have 5.5% worth of rates to cut, and what will do very, very well when rates rapidly get cut? Bond values. Problem is, you might not actually have time to buy bonds before the market adjusts so quickly because of a Fed rate cut. So, a lot of bond buying right now being driven by speculation that there'll be capital appreciation. Problem with that is, we're clearly seeing more bonds being sold than being bought. On the election front, debaters yesterday at the Republican debate argued that Donald Trump didn't necessarily have electability. But reality is, based on at least the latest polls, he might even have more electability than Joe Biden. Now, Politico here suggests Biden and Trump are essentially tied, but if you look at the latest ABC MSNBC poll, you see Trump actually beating Biden by 9 percentage points. So even though you have individuals who might like Nikki Haley, for example, or Vivek or Ron DeSantis, they see the best chance at beating Biden as a vote for Trump. Politico goes as far as suggesting Vivek just dropped to place number 4 following Nikki Haley's move to position number 3 after Trump and DeSantis. Shout out to YouTube though. Yesterday while I was live with 60,000 viewers for the Republican debate coverage and Trump coverage and commentary and fact checking that I was conducting live, thank you to all of those of you who were there. If you want to watch the summary of the debate that I gave, make sure to go on my channel, just type in YouTube, Meet Kevin, debate summary, it should pop up, or go to my channel and find it. I just want to shout out YouTube though. During the debate stream, Fox News actually copyright striked my channel and shut my stream down. All of a sudden, it just went offline. Then YouTube actually stepped in, refused Fox's strike, and let me continue streaming. Now, unfortunately, the viewership went from like 60,000 to 14,000, but YouTube actually said, let Kevin add commentary and talk about the debate. You can't copyright strike him. Impressive move by YouTube. On top of this, a last-minute deal from Kevin McCarthy to avoid a government shutdown beginning this weekend isn't likely, with Kevin McCarthy making big demands, but unfortunately bringing little leverage to the table. That's because Kevin McCarthy is stuck between the will and desire of Democrats in the Senate and presidency and that of hardline Republicans in the House. Despite all this, Gen Z is suggested to be the potentially most struggling generation after the pandemic, suggesting that young adults don't understand the fundamentals of borrowing, including interest rates. They don't realize how high these debt costs are likely to balloon on them. The economic climate is one where people are paying an increasing amount of their disposable income to service their debts, as well as just basic living expenses, because once again, prices of everything are much higher now than they were before the pandemic. The New York Times suggests that Gen Z is basically ignorant. And Gen Z, just for reference, is deemed to be born between 1997 and about 2012. 29% of Gen Z say their finances are better now than pre-pandemic, compared to 21% across other cohorts. Maybe they'll realize one of the reasons that's happening is because they're taking on debt just to sustain, and that this is potentially a shaky way to stay ahead. Gen Z is at a distinct disadvantage because 15% of a credit score is driven by length of your debt history, your credit score history. That means on average, if you're under 25, your credit score is probably only around 679 compared with 714 for all Americans. Now, many of you have really loved the Daily Wealth emails that we send out. They're totally for free. You can click that newsletter link down below. You'll see it next to the link for Meet Kevin, the new Burst Pro Crash Courses, which have a price increase tomorrow at about 11:59 p.m. And then, of course, House Hack, my real estate startup. Check out House Hack. We are now fundraising from nearly all investors. Learn more by going to househack.com. Read the offering circular for risk. So, daily wealth email that I want to touch on today is the idea of multiple streams of income. So many people still regularly come to me and say, but Kevin, I need passive income, so I'm going to invest in dividend stocks. And so you get people who are working for their money, and they're like, oh, I'm doing great. I'm taking passive income in from these dividend stocks by investing in, let's say, blue chip stocks that are trending, some of them are trending towards bankruptcy, but whatever. They're cheering passive incomes. They're like, yeah, I just made $100 of passive income. There are two big problems with passive income. Number one, say you pay 30% on that passive income. Now your $100 becomes $70. People are like, oh, but I reinvest it. So what? You still had to pay the money. Why not instead invest in something that can lead to capital appreciation rather than dividends when you don't need them? If you're actively working, you generally do not need passive income. What you want is passive wealth. You want asset appreciation, which doesn't get taxed. Think about it. If you take $100 and you grow it at 10%, you have $110. If you take $100 and then pay 30% in taxes because you had passive income, and then that grows at 10%, you're at $77. And that spread becomes massively wider and wider and wider over time. Now, some people say, oh, but eventually you'll have to pay the taxes, right? Not necessarily. If you follow the tax tricks we talk about in the courses on building growth, you might never have to pay taxes on your capital appreciation, whether it's stocks or real estate, should you have capital appreciation. Now, obviously, this isn't tax advice, although we will be having a Newverse Pro crash course on how to never pay taxes in America. Check that out at meetkevin.com. It's worth remembering that if you're so excited about passive income while you're still working, you might have things backwards. Focus on capital appreciation and minimizing paying taxes. In the future, when you go to retire, that's when it's generally a lot more savvy or wise to rotate towards passive income.
Why not advertise these things that you told us here? I feel like nobody else knows about this.
We'll try a little advertising and see how it goes.
Congratulations, man. You have done so much. People love you. People look up to you.
Kevin Paffrath there, financial analyst and YouTuber. Meet Kevin. Always great to get your take.